Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And all these fears and these feelings are held inside. And I'm getting too old to fight.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs? Y'all like the Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs are a feel-good country band from Little Rock that has released three full-length studio albums, including the band's current album, Brand New Reason. Their music has been featured on TLC's hit TV show, Trading Spaces, and on the new Sundance Channel hit, Rectify. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be heard at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to a special edition of Tales from the South, a monthly series we call the Tin Roof Project, where well-known Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, all right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has appeared with John Weston twice on Beale Street Caravan radio show. He wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight our featured artist is Little Rock painter Jim Jolly with his painting right over here, which is entitled Rocky 11, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting at Jim at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Philip Martin is a columnist, editor, and the chief film critic at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. He is the author of the essay collections, The Artificial Southerner and The Shortstop's Son, and co-author with Rex Nelson of the Hillary Clinton biography, The Hillary Factor. He has won more than 40 regional and national journalism awards during his tenure at the newspaper, including two Green Eyeshade Awards, and he was a finalist for the 2012 James Hurst Poetry Prize. He is also the monkey in the nose cone at blooddirtandangels.com, a culture blog from the perspective of a self-identified Southerner who still reads novels and likes baseball, dogs, and punk rock music. His first album of original songs, Gastonia, was released in March 2013 and is now available on iTunes and through most other digital outlets. Born in Savannah, Georgia, Martin has played pro baseball in South America and rhythm guitar in garage bands. He lives in the Hillcrest neighborhood of Little Rock with his wife, Karen, and three rescued terriers. Tonight, Philip tests the limits of fate and discovers love in Rescued. Ladies and gentlemen, Philip Martin.
Many years ago in the city of Chicago, there lived a little bald electrical engineer. And he married a woman who had aspirations unusual for a time. She read Goethe in the original German. She was a feminist. She studied literature at the University of Chicago under the novelist Robert Herrick. She wanted to be a writer. And he loved her very much. So much that the little bald engineer engaged the services of a famous architect to build her a house. And being an engineer and more concerned with form, with function than with form, he left the details of that house to his wife and the architect. And so she spent many hours in the great man's company talking about the house, and literature, and art, and music. And the architect's travels to far-off distant lands. The house got built. Conversation continued. And this being American and all, metastasized into an affair. It was messy. There were children involved. But the center wouldn't hold. And after years of domestic subterfuge and denial, the engineer's wife embarked on what she called a spiritual hajira, kind of like an eat-pray-love situation. She ran off to Europe with the architect, who loved her very much. So much that he built for his muse in the prairie country a shining house upon a hill. One day, the architect went into Chicago on business. And the cook he'd hired took an axe and killed the engineer's wife and her two children who were visiting and four other people. And he burned that beautiful house to the ground. Word got to Chicago about lunchtime. And the architect and the engineer, they went back to the country on a train that afternoon. They were in the same private car, keep them away from the press. I've often wondered what, if anything, was said on that trip, and I've sometimes thought about writing a play, one act, two characters, but I've never been able to hack my way through the knot of snarl and sadness. But anyway, they arrived at the house and they walked over the charred grounds together. They were civil to each other, all the press reports said, and when the engineer made to leave, carrying the ashes of his children, box he could hold in one hand, he spoke with no strife and no trouble in his voice. He said, "Goodbye, Frank." I spent the worst night of my life in Chicago on the weekend before Christmas 23 years ago. My wife at the time was living there, pursuing her PhD at the U of C, Saul Bellow and Alan Bloom's Committee on Social Thought, and I was living on Little Rock. Every Friday I'd drive up, arriving at our apartment after midnight, and I thought our problems were due to the long-distant nature of our relationship and the financial strain of maintaining two households on an alternative journalist salary. When I got her on the phone, she was distracted, and I didn't even see her much during our visits. I knew if our marriage was going to work, I was going to have to move. And I was optimistic driving up through snowy Missouri that Friday evening. I had an interview with the Chicago Sun-Times on Monday morning, so I cashed my paycheck. I was going to be opening a bank account in a big city. First thing we did when I got there was like we always did. We went out to the 24-hour grocery store and picked up some provisions. We weren't talking much, and I noticed that she was willfully detached, and after a while I stopped trying to force a conversation. And in this sallow, shadowless light of that supermarket, Everything looked unwholesome and mean, and we rode back in silence. I got out of the car and I saw him. Corner of my eye, my lizard brain profiled him as dangerous. And I shifted the bags I was carrying from my right arm to my left. But hey, here's plenty of reasons. A little skinny little guy in a hoodie might be lurking outside the U of C married student housing complex at 2 a.m. on a freezing December night. And so for just a moment, I was a little bit ashamed of myself. But then he took a couple quick steps toward us, holding a screwdriver with a Dixie cup balanced on the tip of its blade in his hand, and I roughly pushed my wife through our building, through our outer door, into the foyer where she stumbled and spilled our groceries, and I yelled at her to get inside, which meant she had to unlock the inner door as I made it through the outer one, as our mugger, for his intentions were clear to me now, grabbing at my heavy coat. And I do not know how I caught him in the door jam. But I do remember I held him helpless, leaning on the door of my left shoulder as I punched him with my right hand. Again and again and again and again. In his head, in his face. What was pent up was coming out. And he cussed and he spat and he swore, and I kept on hitting him until somehow he slipped away, fell away from the door, scrambled his feet and began to run. And I went after him. I chased him down Ellis Avenue in the south side of Chicago, the baddest part of town, till I understand how foolish I looked, and I turned around and walked back, sweating, crying, and heartsick, and scared finally, and drained. And I looked down, my hand was throbbing, and the blood on my face, the gore on my hands, was not my own. First thing I saw was my reflection in the inner door. And I saw her looking at me. And I saw horror in her eyes. She was afraid of me. And I don't blame her. She wouldn't let me in. But she did come out. She sat on the stoop while I paced back and forth, ranting, waiting for the police. And I don't know why, when they got there, I started asking her questions and shaking their heads at my stupidity, that I was so belligerent. There were $700 bills in my wallet that night, and I don't know of a time before or since I've ever had that much cash on my person. So I guess I was lucky to be alive. I didn't feel lucky. Felt like my life was over. They left. I went to a hotel and spent some of that cash for a room. I headed back to Little Rock the next morning. Less than a year later, I took a job in Phoenix, Arizona. My ex-wife went to Paris to continue her studies at Sorbonne. And in Arizona, I live without furniture. I found myself a murder case to dig into, and I never thought I'd ever come back to Arkansas. I never thought I'd ever come back to the South. But a newspaper editor asked me to, so I took advantage of his offer to fly in for an interview and visit some old friends. And as I walked into the office of the Democrat Gazette, I saw a girl I'd met a couple of years before. We'd met at a street fair, and we'd sit on a curb on Scott Street, talk for an hour or so. And because I was married, because she was involved, we didn't do anything else. And a couple weeks later, I was at her house in Capitol View after midnight, in that pleasant state that a couple of drinks can deliver you to when you are in the company of someone you thoroughly enjoy. And she opened up her back door, and in came a rangy black beast, all sideways, slipping legs and hot drool. And I laughed and I tackled him, and we rolled on the floor, and I guess I passed the audition. I do not like to say too much about my luck for fear it will evaporate. Things can change in an instant. We cannot account for all the world's mad and damaged and sorrowful, or keep your loved ones safe. Your house may burn down. Your very cells may rebel against you. And I can say with some certainty that you and all you love will die. There have been novels and operas written about the tragic love between Frank Lloyd Wright and his beautiful muse, Mama, whom he liberated from a life of bourgeois comfort. But like Mrs. Lohman said, attention must be paid. Edwin Cheney was the name of that little bald engineer who looked like Elmer Fudd. He continued to live in that now famous house for a few years, and he remarried, and in the 20s, he moved to Missouri. He had more children. I hope, I even suspect, that he found happiness. But I'm just making that part up. I don't know about me, and I don't believe much. I know faith is a gift which not everyone is blessed. But I believe there is hope, and that we might be rescued. Not because we are good and worthy, not by works, but by grace, by the kindness of others. I believe in love. I believe in its resuscitating power. Hell, like the Baptists say, I don't just believe in it. I have seen it done. Thank y'all.
So thank you so much, Philip Martin, for being on the Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South.
It is my absolute delight.
So in Chicago, 23 years ago, you get into the violent altercation with the mugger. Had you ever been in a fight before this?
I grew up as a physically competent person. I played games as a kid, and I am not afraid of a little, but no, I believe in kindness, and I'm not a fighter. And I understand why someone might be very horrified to see me do what I did that night. And it was a stupid thing, and I'm not especially proud of it, but it makes a good story, so.
You had never been in a fight before or since?
Well, I wouldn't say I'd never been in a fight, but I've never, and no, not like that, no. Not anything serious, ever, and never again.
Lesson learned. When you moved to Arizona, you said that you thought you'd never come back to the South.
Now, you know, I was on the cusp of my 30s then, and I, at that point in my life, I was, I think, pretty much careerist. I mean, I really could see a line where I was going to Phoenix, going to Los Angeles, going to New York. I was working for a pretty big place in Phoenix. I had an office. I had a secretary I could call and get me a plane ticket. I could do this. I could do that. And it's one of those things that I think that I just didn't countenance it. I didn't really think there was much of a future here for me, which shows you how wrong I am. I
mean, what was it like for you when you came back to the South after being in those places? And I know this was home to you in a lot of ways.
Well, you know, I grew up, I lived all around the country. I lived in California, I lived in North Carolina. I identify as a Southerner, and it's sort of like being Jewish. It's sort of like being, you know, it's an identity you can carry with you and pull out when you want to. I mean, my book, The Artificial Southerner, is really about the mask that we all put on. I'm never more Southern than when I'm in New York City. And I'm never, seriously, you know. And the South is a place we were the part of the country that was occupied. We were a conquered country. We were the cradle of America's original sin, you know, slavery. I mean, we have a lot of stuff to work through. And, you know, I'm happy to work through it. I mean, it's very interesting to be a writer here and to be from here. I think sometimes we make a little bit too much of our accidents of nativity. I mean, I'd be perfectly happy, I think, you know, living in Washington or New Zealand. You know, I mean, I'm Paris, France, but I identify as a Southerner because that's the part of me that comes out when I'm doing this stuff. You know, mainly it's when I'm working with this or with a keyboard. You know, that's sort of what I am.
In your story, you mentioned that you passed the audition with the, quote, rangy black beast, all sideways slipping legs and hot drool, which
Cold
is a
Dog.
Great image.
Anybody remember Cold Dog? He used to write some stuff for the newspaper, yeah. Cold Dog died about 2006, but he ain't never gone, you know? I mean, he's still here. And, you know, I sort of measure out my life now in dogs. You know, it's like we just got to kind of send in the replacements. You know, we went through a span recently, well, I say recently, starting with Coley in 2006, we lost three that were about 15 years old, boom, boom, boom. And, you know, we just keep going with new ones, rescue dogs and, you know, terriers. Terriers are great. I used to be a big dog chauvinist, but you know, big dogs are wonderful. Little dogs are great, too. They're very smart. They're very too smart.
All right. Well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
Why Frank Lloyd Wright?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that. Well, I am interested. There's a couple things. I've always been interested in architecture, and I admire Wright as an artist. And one of the things that happened when I went to Phoenix, actually, was I got a chance to do a lot of research and investigate and got a lot of Mr. Wright's acolytes, as they call themselves, really mad at me for writing about his you know, some of the stuff. And I was really fascinated by the cult that surrounds the guy and his longevity. I mean, and he's, and these stories. I mean, the Mamum Boatwright Shaney story is just fascinating. I really did intend to, at some point, write a play about that or write something about that, but I just, you know, I'm just making it up. I mean, it's kind of hard for me to go. It turns out that Edwin Shaney, you know, there's evidence that maybe he wasn't quite the tragic figure that I sort of portray him. I mean, I found this out later, but I mean, he may have started up with a woman himself right after Mama started up, so I don't know. And it was, and they were all friends, and they were in the 19th century women's club together, and it was really kind of complicated, more complicated than I make it, but then, you know, what's a writer for, if not to oversimplify? Yes?
Do you think films are getting better? Or
no.
Do you think they're getting worse?
I think that there is an opportunity right now for people to make movies, and we're going to have a lot of really great movies. But 90% of what we're going to have is drunk, like we've always said. I think that if you're talking about Hollywood, commercial movies are getting worse because people in Hollywood figured out how to sell movies to people who don't really care about movies. You know, and so you've got people who just go for the explosions and just go for the special effects and just go for this, and that's fine. I mean, they just go for the sensation, but we've lost. I mean, the movies in the 70s, the early 70s movies that, you know, you've lost those. They went to independent cinema, and now independent cinema really, you know, is hurting, and, you know, but if you want to see a character-driven thing, you know, you'll be able to see it on the internet. You'll be able to see it in your iPad. You'll be able to see it on Netflix. But, you know, as far as going to the movies and going to the Cinemark now, or, you know, you're going to get the same thing again and again, you know, because that's what people go to. It's like McDonald's. You know, people go to McDonald's more than they come here.
Unfortunately, that is true.
Billions and billions, you know.
All right, so how about our story and storyteller tonight? Thank you so much, Philip Martin, for being on our Tin Roof Project here at Tales from the South. More can be found out about Philip at his blog, blooddirtandangels.com. Thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Tonight's show is sponsored by William F. Lehman Public Library, with additional support provided by the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.
Sipping these cheap booze, another memory of a girl that I should have held on to. It's just another day in the life of a fool, and I'm singing another sad country song, a song about a heartache. Sad state of mind has caused me to start thinking, well, this honky-tonk living is gonna drive me to drinking. Another song on the jukebox that I choose. Still in love with you, memory of the girl, and I should have held on to. It's just another day in the life of a fool, and I'm singing another sad country song, that song about is gonna drive me to drinking. Oh, this honky tonk living is gonna drive me to drinking.